Welcome to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast. Behavior Analysis in Practice is a podcast committed to narrowing the research practice gap and demystifying the research process. Each episode will take a deep dive into the latest work published in Behavior Analysis in Practice, the journal, by interviewing the paper's author about the topic. We'll explore the nuances of each paper and ask the questions you wish you could ask the authors after reading the paper. Hello and welcome back to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast. I'm your host, Cody Morris, Assistant Professor of Behavior Analysis of Salve Regina University. And today I'm going to be speaking with Drs. Shayna Berry and Peter Gerhardt about their paper, The Ethics of Actually Helping People, Targeting Skill Acquisition Goals That Promote Meaningful Outcomes for Individuals with Autism Spectrum Disorder. Dr. Berry received her PhD in Applied Behavior Analysis from Endicott College under the advisement of Dr. Gerhardt. She has authored several publications and presented nationally and internationally. She currently serves as the Executive Director of Meaningful Hope, an agency committed to helping practitioners and families best support individuals with disabilities in preparing for a meaningful life in adulthood. She is also an adjunct professor at Endicott College. Dr. Gerhardt is the Executive Director of the EPIC programs in New Jersey. He has over 40 years experience using behavior analysis to support adolescents and adults with autism spectrum disorder in educational, employment, residential, and community-based settings. Dr. Gerhardt serves as the co-chairman of the Scientific Council for the Organization for Autism Research and is on numerous professional advisory boards, including the Cambridge Center for Behavioral Studies. He also serves as an adjunct faculty at Endicott College. I really enjoyed my conversation with Drs. Berry and Gerhardt about this topic of meaningful outcomes in adulthood. I think you'll enjoy it too. So without further ado, here's my interview with Drs. Berry and Gerhardt. Hi, Shayna and Peter. Welcome to Behavior Analysis and Practice, the podcast. We're excited to have you here today.
Excited to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Now, I'm really, really interested in talking about your paper. I think it really hits on a really important topic in behavior analysis. But before we jump into the paper, we always like to hear a little bit about our guest. So would each of you mind telling us a little bit about what your current role is? And how you found yourself working on a project like this. If you don't mind, maybe we can start with Shayna.
Sure. I'm Dr. Shayna Berry. I'm currently founder and executive director of Meaningful Hope. We do consulting and continuing ed work, specifically kind of at the core of what this paper is about, kind of teaching practitioners, students, and other parents as well, just kind of the skills that individuals with autism need to best position themselves for a meaningful life in adulthood. I'm also an adjunct professor at Endicott College, where I got my PhD under Dr. Gerhardt. So that's kind of how I got into all of this. I've been working in a number of settings throughout my career and just had kind of seen where adulthood ends up and where children with autism end up as adults. So kind of just seeing what is out there in adulthood kind of really made me passionate about making sure these kids are prepared for the long term.
And the organization that you refer to, is that a regional thing? Is that people who are interested in sort of nationally or even internationally? Is that accessible?
Yep. National, international. So everything can be virtual. Also, I'm local to Rhode Island and Southeast Massachusetts. So those kind of areas in person as well.
Awesome. Thank you. And then Peter, would you mind telling us a little bit about your current role and how you found yourself wrapped up in this project?
I'm Dr. Peter Gerhardt. I'm the executive director of the EPIC programs in Paramus, New Jersey. That includes the EPIC School, EPIC Foundation, and our brand new program, EPIC Inclusive Communities, which is our adult program. I'm affiliate faculty at Endicott and the co-chair of the Scientific Council for the Organization for Autism Research. I became involved in the project Mary Jane Weiss, who's the dean at Endicott in behavioral studies, asked me if I wanted to supervise doctoral students. Mary Jane Weiss asked me to do something. I generally say yes. So I did that, and I was really lucky that I ended up with three bright, enthusiastic, forward-looking doc students who really helped revitalize my thinking in the process. So, as Shana was moving forward with this, it was my great honor to be part of it. So,
That's awesome. And it's such an important topic. And for the listeners, this probably will become apparent as we get into the conversation. I've known Shana for quite some time. We've had conversations around this, and I'm really excited to like really dive into it and get to have read the paper and everything. So yeah, I think it's a great topic. I'm excited. Now, to kind of jump into the paper, at the beginning of your paper, you provide a quote by B.F. Skinner that I think sort of helps establish the purpose of the paper. The quote is, "One has most effectively helped others when one can stop helping them altogether." Can you talk about what that quote means to you in this topic and why that, I think, was, in my opinion, such an awesome quote to kind of start to build the context for this and how it all kind of ties in?
Yeah, I love that quote. That's probably one of my favorite B.F. Skinner quotes. So in that book chapter, at that part or before the quote, he's talking about seeing an individual kind of struggling to tie their shoes and how with that struggle, the adult watching the struggle kind of has like these jitters and they're feeling uncomfortable watching them struggle. So they kind of jump in and just tie their shoes for them. And he talks about how in that moment, that adult completely took away a teaching and learning opportunity that they'll never get back. So then he kind of goes into that quote that you just read. And I just think it's so important because I think everyone is well-intentioned who either works with or parents and individuals with a disability. So we want to help. That's just kind of the nature of someone in the field or someone with a loved one with a disability. But I just think it's so important to think about because we really care. We really want to be thinking about how we can show and kind of care in a better way, and that would be really kind of teaching individuals to not need that help in the long run.
Yeah, the big. Oh, go ahead, Peter.
No, I was going to say that I would add that, like at the EPIC school, one of our guiding principles is independence is more important than perfection. You know, and on any given day, I'm probably 85% accurate in everything I do, but nobody error corrects me. Nobody makes me go. Nobody says you can't do that anymore. You know, now I'm also not making life or death errors, but the fact of the matter is we overprotect and infantilize adults on the spectrum as opposed to letting them be adults on the spectrum because they don't need our help all the time. Like if we've done our job right, we should be able to step back and let them be themselves.
I love that quote that you had there. The was it the
Independence is more
independence?
important than perfection.
Yeah, I love that. And I think about, I mean, I want to be careful to make sure we get through everything because I think there's just so many like rabbit holes of conversations we can get down on this stuff because I think it's such a cool topic. But I think it's very easy to slip into being nitpicky about our learners sometimes and holding them to a much higher standard than we would hold any other student in any other educational setting of they have to get this amount of accuracy and they have to have this and they have to be sitting in their chair all and it's like all these things. It's like have you been to a typically developing children like elementary school? It's not the way things look sometimes, right? Like that those kids in those schools aren't hitting 100% 100% of the time. It's not realistic. And so I like that. And I think the importance of autonomy and independence is huge. And that ties into another point you made early in your paper about adult outcome data and what those look like. Can you speak to those a little bit to kind of help build the context for those that might be newer to this particular topic?
Yeah, they're pretty much they're just poor overall. Kind of across all measures, there have been so many studies that have looked at it, a number of different measures. Longitudinally, they're poor across things like post-secondary education, living arrangements, physical, emotional, mental health, socialization, just pretty much any context by which people individuals measure outcomes in the research and what adulthood looks like. All the measures we have right now are all pointing to that individuals with autism are drastically underachieving compared to typical peers and also peers with other disability labels. So, and it's been this way for decades. So it's really, it's not a new problem that we're drawing attention to in the paper. It's been so many other researchers who've been talking about this for literally decades. So we kind of really just wanted to draw more attention to it again and kind of in this paper present some ideas about how we really have a responsibility to fix this because it's been going on so long and because we're not doing enough to really help.
Related to that comment about the responsibility or behavior analyst responsibility, most behavior analysts work with children, right, with autism and related disabilities. Can you talk about how you see behavior analysts broadly, maybe even folks that are working with children, how they might be responsible? Or have some responsibility in helping improving these adult outcomes.
Well, Shane and I often talk about adulthood begins in preschool. Typical kids start to learn the base skills that then they can build upon. It's like the scaffolding of all these skills. And then they get to a point where they can expand their entire skill repertoire. But we can't start at 14 and expect them to pick up all the skills they should have been learning for the past 14 years. There needs to be this much more longitudinal understanding of behavior analytic intervention and support and services than there currently is now. We tend to look to like the end of the year, the end of the insurance cycle, the end of, as opposed to like, where is this all going? Like, where are we going to go with this? And how do we give him the best possible life?
Yeah, I think we talk a lot in the paper about how a really clear way we can do that is by making sure we're teaching the right skills, the right way, the right environment. We talk a lot about adaptive behavior skills in the paper, and that's another really key outcome measure that we really focus on because it's one that we kind of have the most kind of quote unquote control over, and that we have the ability to choose the skills that we're teaching, with a team of individuals, including the learner whenever they can, their family. But adaptive behavior is just so critical to outcomes. Again, looking at all the research, if you have adaptive behavior skills, you're in a much better position for adulthood, much better position to have, less reliance on other people. So adaptive behavior essentially is just independent skills and being able to do things yourself.
I love that. And I love Peter's point about you can't just like start these things at 14 and expect someone to be ready to
Right.
go at 18 or whatever age they kind of transition officially into adulthood from a billing perspective. It's these things take a lifetime to build. We, as typically developing adults, have spent our lifetime developing those things, right? Like, I always talk to my students about independence and autonomy, and I go, what point do you have independence and autonomy? And they're like, wait, well, you're an adult. And I go, how many of you might be getting support, financial support from your family or, whatever it is? It's like, this is a continuum, right? And this is something that we're typically working on throughout the course of our lives. And something that I think is apparent that the individuals we work with should also be working on, right?
Yeah, we talk about the difference between independence and interdependence.
Right.
None of us are independent.
Yeah.
It's, I didn't build the computer that I'm on right now. Like,
Right.
I rely on other people. The skill that I have and that Shayna has and that you have is we know how to find the supports we need. That's what interdependence is. And we know whether it's another person or something on our iPhone or whatever, that's what allows us to have this patina of independence. But we're really relying on a whole lot of prompts from other things.
Yeah. That makes sense. Now, your paper, we're sort of bringing to the purpose of this paper here. You kind of take on four purposes within this paper. Could you speak about what you're aiming at in this particular paper, or what you sort of provided resources-wise within this paper?
So essentially, part of what we've talked about already, we wanted to draw attention to the problem of poor adult outcomes, which we've talked about. We talk a lot about kind of potentially unintended contributions to the problem. So they're basically how we are kind of hypothesizing how we got here, again, because we think that everyone in this field is well-intentioned, but we think that we got here kind of from some missteps along the way, potentially. And then we really wanted to just provide some practice guidelines based on the ethics code. So we highlight two major ethical themes that we go through and kind of talk about how they're important and how they're supported by the code and how they can really guide our practice, even though the code doesn't have specific populations it's meant to be for, and there aren't specific, credentialing for working with individuals with autism. But we believe what we have now is pretty sufficient if we just kind of dive into it a little deeper and interpret it in kind of different ways than maybe are they're typically interpreted. So that's kind of the main purpose, what we wanted to do.
Thank you. And to your point, we've been talking about this problem with the poor adult outcomes. And you provided that explanation of adaptive behaviors. Some of the complications we haven't sort of directly talked about yet that you outlined in your paper was this idea like there's very little funding for adult services, right? And I've worked for context, I've worked in the world of adult services, group homes, adult day programs. And in fact, that's kind of where I started within behavior analysis. And so this section really spoke to me as someone who's sort of seen what that looked like. Yeah, there are services for adults, group homes, adult day programs, other resources, but very rarely are there enough resources within those contexts to provide meaningful opportunities to gain skills and independence and autonomy? It's really kind of like maybe maintenance isn't a fair word to use for a lot of those programs, but it's really about getting them activated, but less about them kind of gaining skills. Can you speak about some of the other sort of complications within the adult services world that make it important to target these earlier rather than later?
Well, I think part of the problem is that people who work in the educational systems don't have a vision about what adulthood looks like. So if you don't, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. That's how it sort of works. I do think, although I don't necessarily know if this is feasible, but I think every educator who works in behavior analysis and special education should have to spend a week working in an adult day program. That's sort of like the ghost of Christmas yet to come, and get a sense of like, unless you do your job better, this is what happens. Why I said I don't know if it's feasible. I don't think there are a lot of programs out there that said, yeah, let me be an example of a shitty program. Come on in,
Yeah. I love that though. I've had a sort of a fantasy that I've had since becoming program director here at Solvay that we would have some rotation where it's like you work with the kids, you work with adults just to get the perspective. Because to your point, when I started in the adult world and I saw what group homes look like and I saw where at different levels of group homes look like, there's a really big difference in quality of life from a group home that is like people can go out into the community by themselves, they're not tied to the staff, right? Versus the group homes where they're not going to the community without staff. That means they have to wait for staff to become available, and typically for the rest of the people in the house to become available. They're only doing things in a group. So huge, huge quality of life difference. When I see people working with younger children and I see things like this is an example I give to my students, but one time I went to a clinic and they were working on like a tacting protocol with a child. It was let's say 11 or 12 or something like that, and they were tacting dinosaurs. It's all sorts of different types of dinosaurs, and I go, why are you working on that lesson with them? I'm assuming dinosaurs must be like this kid's like favorite thing. Like, he just like love the dinosaurs and that's like meaningful. They're like, no, that he doesn't really care for it. It's like, okay, well, why are you spending so much time working on dinosaurs? How is that useful. And I get obviously tacting, you might, you have, different types of targets so you can get generalized outcomes. I understand all of that, but at what point are you just so focused on a lesson for the sake of the lesson, and you're not, to Peter, your point, tying it into the bigger outcome? And I agree with you that if people have spent any time working with adults, you understand the importance of this road that you're on, and how meaningfully different the outcomes can be if you target certain things early enough.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. And I also want to just follow up, because I don't want people to think all adult services are bad. Just like you said, I think there are pockets of excellence in every state. There are people doing really good jobs, like helping people have real independent, individualized lives. But I also think they tend to keep it really quiet. So there are a lot of good people in the field doing really good stuff, but we just don't sort of know it. All we know about are the bad examples.
Yeah,
So.
I mean, even the great services, because I've certainly gotten to partner with a lot of tremendous adult services, they're going to be the first ones to tell you, yes, please target these things earlier, because they're the ones that know how important, certain skill sets are, because they're the ones that are having to go. They want everyone being as independent and autonomous as possible, just like we do. But they're tied to these skills, and they're going to do what they can to try to chip away at those skills. But what can they do? Like you said, if I have a 47-year-old that's never worked on some of these independent skills in a meaningful way, that's just not a realistic, or it's not a very favorable situation that the adult services find themselves in.
Yeah, I think if people who work with kids would just have any basic idea of what's coming, I think it would drastically improve, because I think there's a lot of kind of passing the buck on to like the next classroom teacher or the next grade or the next, program they go into. And I think there's a preconceived notion that they'll target that in adult services. I've heard teachers and, behavior analytics staff say that, and I just think such a misconception that there's all this teaching, reinforcement, staffing, resources, funding available in adulthood, that it's because it makes sense. Why wouldn't there be, generally speaking? But there's the reality is there just isn't. So I think if anyone who works with kids just programmed with that in mind, that they're working with time-limited resources, I think it could drastically impact, what we're doing and get people to stop and think, like, why are we working on
Yeah, I don't. Hey, that's not my job. I don't work with
this?
adults, right? I'm just here to train letter identification or
Yeah.
whatever it might be. Yeah, well, there are certain prerequisite skills, right? Just like
think
in a preschool.
everyone you work with is a future adult, so I think that's what we need to really be thinking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you in your paper, you outlined some of the contributors or reasons we're in the situation we are. You looked at kind of the historical context, and you talked about part of the complication and the reason we're in this current situation is the funding structures for services for children. Can you speak about those and talk about how they contribute to the complexity of the issue right now?
If you look at the educational system, it's an entitlement. Like it's basically a right. Now the problem is that that right is wrapped up in a really weak word, which is appropriate. It's free appropriate public education, not the free best public education, or even necessarily good. It's appropriate, but at least it's a right. Once you graduate out of that system, it's not a right. Like different states have different laws, and almost all say you should have adult services, but that doesn't mean you will have adult services, and especially not residential services. So it's a completely different system. I get tuition at the school on an annual basis. In the adult program, I have to bill 15-minute intervals just like every other insurance program. And if one of my adults doesn't show up, like I can't make any money that day. I can't pay a staff person. It's a whole different system that way that makes it much more challenging than I think it needs to be.
I was just going to say one of the other points in the paper we make is how the kind of the historical context of special ed and how we started with We want to make sure that everyone has a right to education. So the whole inclusion push, and then once we got there, we kind of shifted to making sure that, well, they have a right to the general education curriculum. And it's kind of a mentality of teaching functional skills is like a less than model of education. So there was a real push that, they have a right to learning gen ed, so we have to teach them that. And we can teach anything with our science, and special ed has, a lot of capabilities to do great work too. So, but I think that was one of the missteps that we really wanted to highlight, is that that's how we kind of how we got here, and kind of having kids in the special education system kind of locked into being having to be taught things from the Common Core standard. So again, well-intentioned, but we want to it can become a real problem if we're boxed into teaching those Common Core skills and not being at least creative with them and making sure that we're teaching those Common Core skills in a way that's really going to be functional and matter and really help them get into a better place in adulthood.
That makes a lot of sense. I've been in treatment programs where, and this isn't their fault at all. This is because, they were locked into the educational curriculum, but they're working on like identification of historic figures, right? To kids that have essentially, extremely limited communication skills and certainly very limited functional skills, et cetera. So they're holding up pictures. Who is this? And, no one says anything. Nope, it's Jimmy Carter, and then they put it on and on to the next one. It's like, I get it. They're locked in. It's just tough to see that where they're spending time focusing on skills that oftentimes that I've seen anyway that the students really don't even have the prerequisites for, and then you're missing the opportunity to train so many important like adaptive and functional skills in those moments.
We can teach any of that, with memorization and reinforcement, but it's just like, why are we teaching that? And there can be ways, like I said, to teach some of those Common Core skills in a way that's functional, but we have to be creative. And, on top of, we want to make sure, like in a bigger picture, we want to make sure that kids aren't locked into having to do those standards. But for right now, if they are, we can still be creative and kind of get around them in some ways to still teach skills that are going to be meaningful for them long term.
I think one of the points you spoke about earlier with the independence is better than perfection or something along those lines. I've also been in public ed schools where they're trying to keep the students in the classroom, which is great, right? It's helpful to have them around their peers and things like that. There's a lot of important components of that. But to keep them in the classroom, they're completely reliant on a paraprofessional or someone else to prompt them through the routine. So they essentially have no independence in the classroom doing the classroom work because they're so focused on, yep, inclusion, 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 which again, great for several reasons. But if you're prompting all the way through and they're not actually meaningfully connecting with the lessons in the classroom and rely on prompting the entire time, it seems like you could be setting them up for a lot of problems on the back end because that paraprofessional is not going to be there in adult services, right? They don't have those resources. I'm falling around and going, hey, like do this and this and this. It's like, it's so in some ways, in my estimation, it seems like it would be better to, even have fewer skills, fewer like academic skills, but more independence and, adaptive skills.
There's another cheat that we use, which is by Gretchen Rubin, who's not a behavior analyst. She's an author. Wrote a book called The Happiness Project. But her thing is, like, what you do every day matters more than what you do once in a while. So
I love
getting up
that.
in the morning, taking a shower, brushing my teeth, getting dressed, going to work, like is more important than factoring a binomial equation. Now,
Absolutely.
I work in a field where I have to do that, So it's all of that other stuff that I do every day that defines an adult life.
Yeah.
I was
So
starting to
that's what I
laugh
call
because
Jeopardy skills.
was going to say, I was starting to laugh because we're at the point where we finish each other's sentences, Peter and I. And I thought where you were going was the in order to kind of cheat. So Peter has said for years, like, if you just add on kind of to the end of a goal, the phrase in order to blank, and just insert, what the point of the goal is, it could really drastically help. Why are they working on identifying US presidents? Is it in order to get to eighth grade? Is it in order to get a history degree in college? Like, what is the point? Is it because it's not going to be in order to, go to the store or purchase something or, do something enjoyable in their future as an adult. So I think that's a really important point to make when we're thinking about goals to teach.
I love that. It's so simple, right? But potentially so profound in its implications. And we'll talk about maybe other suggestions and ideas throughout. But I mean that's huge, right? Just something as simple as orienting us to what is the purpose of what are we currently doing? How does it tie into potentially short and long-term goals and keeping people focused on those things. I love that. Now the so that's like some of the nuance within the special ed funding structure. How about in the insurance coverage funding structure?
I was just going to say, we're probably getting us all off track because me and Peter can definitely just rant about these things. I mean, the medical model is very similar to the special ed model in that it has a lot of the same problems that, come from well-intentioned. So starting early on in the field, where ABA was kind of founded and, we'll get into all the historical aspects of that, but thanks to advocates and, amazing people in our fields got insurance mandated across all 50 states in the US, which has enabled access to ABA for so many individuals, has been, life-changing for so many. But what we see and what Peter and I hear from people all the time is that they're locked into not being able to teach some of these adaptive skills because they're being told that it doesn't meet the criteria of medical necessity. So that's a much bigger topic than we can get into today and even beyond Peter and I's expertise. But kind of the small point we make in this article is just we really want to make sure that we're not discounting the long-term necessity and cost of services into adulthood by not focusing or at least trying to push to make sure we're focusing on these skills. And just like in the special ed model, while we're still bound by standards and medical necessity and things like that, we can still be creative, we think, to try and get around some of the barriers while at the same time pushing to kind of make sure that they're not barriers anymore. So I think we can be creative within, if medical necessity is defined as kind of the core diagnostic criteria of ASD, we can kind of, I don't want to say twist, but kind of make it so that it's really tied to that. And it's kind of comes with being creative with how we're writing goals. And we get into this in much more detail in our book that's coming out, not to shamelessly plug it, but it's too much to talk about, right now. And again, it's not our total area of expertise. We got a lot of help on that chapter, but yeah, kind of it's a big contributor to the problem of even if people go into writing goals with the mindset that, okay, let's teach these really important adaptive skills. We want to make sure they matter. We don't want it to be that they're coming up against, funding restrictions saying, oh, no, you can't teach that because of this.
Yeah, and I think that book will be incredibly valuable, and if it's available by the time we release, we'll be sure to link to it in the show notes because this is such an important, incredibly important topic, very, very nuanced, and a lot of sort of variables and complexities within that. In the section of the paper, you talk about the difference between like catch-up goals, catch up, not the condiment, but catching up, and adaptive goals. Can you
Right.
speak about the difference there?
Yeah, talk about kind of like the developmental path versus the adaptive path. So with developmental path, essentially the purpose of those, curricula and assessments and programs designed to fit within that category are essentially you're trying to catch them up to same age peers. So if they're 4 years old, the mentality is that you're trying to catch them up to a typically developing 4-year-old who's meeting all those developmental milestones. Whereas the adaptive path, kind of the purpose of, curricula assessment and goals tied to that path would be essentially to function in life as an adult. So we talk a lot about, at what point do you want to shift from one to another? So even what you mentioned earlier, Cody, of like seeing individuals who are older adolescents, I mean, that's a lot of what stirred my passion. This is I had, individuals who were 19 working on these early developmental tacting milestones, well-intentioned in a lot of ways in that they're thinking we want to make sure they're meeting goals. And but at that point, you have to realistically think about, are they on track to catch up to a typically developing 19-year-old? If we're working on tacting up to 100 tacks, I don't think they're going to be on track, So yeah, we talk a lot about kind of the difference between those two paths and just kind of we want to encourage practitioners to think critically about when we should be thinking about moving on from developmental to adaptive. If they're not on track, essentially to catch up at a certain age, we really want to start be thinking about transitioning to a more adaptive focused programming, really thinking about that around age 10, once they're getting close to adolescence.
One of the big themes that's sort of underlying a lot of what we're speaking about in this conversation is the value in the time we have with our clients, right? We even 40 hours a week or however many hours a week, it might seem like a lot to especially, people out in society that aren't familiar with behavior analysis, special education. But 40 hours is nothing, right? If we're depending on the individual's needs and stuff like that. But if we're talking about someone with pretty significant developmental disabilities that has, a lot of skills to develop, doesn't have a lot of adaptive skills, 40 hours is like very limited. And we have so much we want to try to get done in that period of time. And to your point, it's like, yeah, in a perfect world, we would do all the tacting and all of these, and we do everything all at once. We don't have that, right? We have to make decisions. And part of what we're looking at here is, trying to, again, help our clients be as independent, autonomous as possible, currently and later in life. And so your paper provides sort of two best practice themes or ideas that start to get at some of this a little bit. Can you talk about those recommendations?
So the first one is basically intentionally choosing what we teach. So we've talked a lot about that already, just kind of making sure we're thinking critically about it. We go through kind of some ways that we want to really encourage people to choose what they teach. So keeping social validity at the center of it, kind of a core principle in our field that we think is overlooked in a lot of ways. We want to be making sure that that's really at the center of everything we do. And then using skill acquisition assessments and curricula as guides, but not roadmaps to programming. We touched on it a little bit, especially with the early developmental assessments and curricula. We want to make sure we're not teaching to the test, kind of, and making sure we're teaching skills, not because they're the next step in a curricula. And we want to make sure, just like what we said earlier, with, why are you teaching this? Or it's the skill is in order to what? It can't be in order to fill in, boxes on a skills assessment grid. We want to make sure we're really choosing intentionally and thinking really critically about why we're teaching certain skills. I don't know,
Yeah,
Tegan,
and
did you want to add to that?
I was just gonna I think as a field, autism intervention within applied behavior analysis has become enamored with our technical integrity. Like everybody's saying the SD the same way. Everybody's waiting precisely 3 seconds before they prompt. Everybody's like, when we should be putting that same amount of effort into glorifying outcomes. As to like, what does this do here? And we should be looking at research outside of the clinic, like outside of the class, outside, like out in the real world, where there's multiple variations on a theme. Shannon knows I have this very weird, twisted fantasy of teaching microwave use, but at a Best Buy. So you have 34 examples. And so
Yeah, that's awesome.
like right there, like do that for 2 weeks. This kid will know how to do a microwave oven for the rest of his freaking life.
I love
You know?
that. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, those are the, that's how my mind works sometimes. I was
Yeah,
gonna say, you
that's
shouldn't preface that with, I have a twisted fantasy. That's gonna sound like
it's probably right,
it's a good fantasy, I think. And frequent listeners and my students well, no, I like to say, if behavior changes in the woods and no one is around to see it, did behavior change at all? Right. And I like that because so many times we're focusing on things in the clinic and it's gonna get perfect in the clinic and all this. And granted, of course, behavior change in clinic is important and it's an important first step often. But if we're not getting to those generalized outcomes, if yeah, they're using the microwave to Peter, your example in the clinic, but they go home and they can't use it, and they go into a group home and they can't use it, or they're at a sort of a public avenue and they can't use a microwave, then what does it matter? Like it to your point, outcomes are absolutely vital. We should be paying attention to it. It's great if you have perfect procedural fidelity in the clinic. If it doesn't end with generalized outcomes and meaningful context, what did it matter? Like, who cares? And so, we've talked about the, choosing what we teach, and maybe this ties into some of these best practices in terms of how we teach. So can we talk about that? So Best Buy is a huge context that we need to train in. It sounds like anything else.
Right. I mean, yeah. So, I mean, best practice team two is intentionally choosing how we teach. And we talk a little bit about how, of course, we want to make sure what we're teaching is evidence-based, but we want to make sure we're getting creative with that and making sure that we understand that behavior analysis is not, seated at a desk, task work, discrete trial teaching with a data sheet with, 10 trials every time you do a lesson. And we want to make sure we're using the science that we have, things like modeling, chaining, prompting, shaping, things like that in natural context. It's still ABA and it's still using our science, but we can be using it better, we believe, and it's being used in a lot of ways. And what Peter, why the Best Buy thing ties into this part is because we talk about consideration areas for how we teach, and those are, the context in which instruction takes place. So making sure we're teaching, not, to your point too, Cody, teaching just in a clinic, in a classroom, we need to be teaching where we want the skill to end up. If the skill is purchasing or something like that, it has to be done where it's going to be used. We can't be expecting it to naturally generalize because research doesn't support that. We know based on research that we have to be teaching in the right context if we want the skill to show up there. And that's kind of like, again, Peter's example of teaching with, the microwave that they're going to use, or are we going to teach with multiple exemplars if we want that generalization to occur? The other consideration is intensity. So teaching enough, to make sure that the skill is actually going to be acquired, which we know in research that that's really important for individuals with disabilities. And then the efficiency of instruction so that the least amount of response effort is needed. I don't know, Peter, if you want to add on to those are your big points too.
No, I think we just sometimes get stuck in that this is how it's supposed to be done. And one of the things I like to emphasize, if you're going to the supermarket and you want to teach, grocery shopping, just let the kid or the go first. Like, let him try and figure out what the sequence should be for doing this, as opposed to trying to impose an artificial sequence. Like, every person I've ever worked with can find the potato chips or the candy aisle. It's not a savant skill. Like, they know, they know. So let's start there. They know that, and then build upon that too. But we go in with out of the curriculum, we pull the grocery shopping program, and that's what we teach.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, what does it matter if they start off in the candy aisle or the chip aisle, right? And then, as long as they're doing their, like, there's no right sequence in a grocery store. What aisle you go through first and how do you do it? Yeah, I love that.
Just another example of us holding learners to a higher standard than we hold ourselves. Like we don't do the same thing the same way in the same order every time. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think the getting sort of those multiple exemplar training opportunities is important. I think I often relate to this when I'm traveling myself, and it seems like every hotel shower is different. And every time I get into a shower in a hotel, I feel like I've stepped into an escape room, and I've got to pull on different levers and do it. It never works the same. It's always difficult. And I think, this is, I have an entire lifetime, I don't know how many different showers I've experienced in my lifetime, a lot. And every time I'm like, okay, I know that there's a hot and cold control somewhere on here, and I know there's a way to turn the shower on, right? But without those exemplars, I'd struggle to do it. And I think about our learners who are only ever given the opportunity to try checking out or buying something in like a in the like a clinic's made grocery store, which is amazing that clinics are doing that. That's an awesome first step. but we need to see it down in the community. We need to see it with the different types of credit card readers and the different type of, cashier checkout area setups and things like that.
Absolutely.
And so these things are very nuanced, right? And to your point, Peter, I think there's a reason that people kind of get into the, well, we do this because this is just the way we do things. And I think it's oftentimes due to a lack of resources or understanding. And so that's why I'm excited about this paper and the book you guys are going to be publishing soon to help unpack some of these things. The next section of your paper talked about the individual responsibility of behavior analysts in interpreting the ethics code versus necessary systemic changes. Can you talk about that?
So a lot of the paper was focused on essentially all the best practice themes we believe can be applied by practitioners who are the ones responsible for writing the goals. So that was a big kind of call to action to make sure we're teaching the right skills the right way. And we kind of provided like a resource to go through the code, and we have a big table in there that provides additional interpretations of specific code items that support the code, the best practice themes. And also we talk about the core principles that are really important and we believe can support these best practice themes, even if the unique standards don't necessarily support it, or if someone argues the other way, like, oh, that's too big of a jump in that interpretation. So we believe we provided a pretty good support for the best practice themes and how to interpret them. So we hope that that's helpful to kind of guide practice and encourage people writing goals to kind of be empowered to teach skills the right way and the right skills essentially. But we also talk about how important it is to also kind of go beyond the individual, but also look at ways that we can be having a bigger impact. Some of the ways we talk about are training the future of the field, essentially using some of these principles and kind of best practice guidelines and how we're training the next generation of behavior analysts. So if we don't make a change now in how we practice, everyone who's practicing right now, a lot of them are supervisors, and it's just going to be a continual cycle of not teaching the right skills, not teaching them the right way, if we're just tr keep continually training the same way that has been taught and hasn't really been working. So kind of incorporating this into supervision and training. I believe we talk about kind of special interest group mentorships, things like that. I don't remember if we talked about it in this paper, but about kind of the clinic rotation that you were talking about at the beginning, Cody. I think you and I have talked about that a lot too. We talk about that in our book too, of just we really think it's important to people get exposure to different populations and kind of taking it, all the times in the code it talks about competence and area of expertise and things like that. We believe working with adolescents and preparing for adulthood is a really kind of unique area that we think needs more attention and more training, supervision, and kind of people to have that defined as their competence and making sure. If you work with 4-year-olds your whole life, we don't believe you're really ready to work with 12, 15, 18-year-olds unless you have a lot of additional training, support, mentorship yourself. So those are some of the big areas that we talk about. I don't know, Peter, if you want to add to that, if I'm missing anything.
No, I think you covered it quite well.
What I love about this paper is it's not particularly long, but you've packed in so many useful considerations and really begun to sort of flesh out this framework of being able to approach this particular topic, right? And how do we help improve adult outcomes and how do we help our clients be as independent and autonomous as possible? And as we've been sort of discussing a lot of nuance and complications there, but in this section of the paper and other sections, you're building kind of some framework and some pieces that will help folks begin to work toward those things, which I find very exciting. You also talk about, which I love as a history geek, you talk about some of the historically relevant contributions to behavior analysis that aren't necessarily reliably being embedded within the practice. Given my sort of history geek status, can we take a minute to talk about that?
Sure. So we kind of go through we outline that section talking about kind of behavior analytic contributions and then contributions from related disciplines, just because we felt they were different and we wanted to highlight, the behavior analysis portion from kind of the rest of the world in terms of, there are multiple disciplines with the same goal, which is to help individuals with disabilities with in the short and long term. So we talk about behavior analytic contributions. We talk about Mott Wolf's 78 paper about social validity and how important that is. We talk about Van Houten's six rights that everyone has when they get behavior analytic treatment. And I believe, yeah, we talk about Bannerman and colleagues 1990, which is one of both Peter and I's favorite articles. Talk about the right to eat too many donuts and take a nap. I don't know, Peter, you want to add on to that, like early contributions in the field? I know those are your favorite articles too.
Yeah, the Bannerman article changed my life, quite honestly. 1990 in Java, like that was like
Yeah.
amazing. So, but like I don't consider myself a radical behavior analyst, but I'm kind of a radicalized behavior analyst. I think much, if not all, the world can be explained through behavior analysis. I just don't understand the contingencies most of the time. But recently, I've been talking with a colleague of mine about Carl Rogers and on becoming a person, and how, unconditional positive regard is really just appropriately presented unconditional reinforcement. It's not that different, this concept. And I think that there's a lot of things we could look outside and interpret with behavior analytic eyes and see how that might fit into changing some of the ways we actually practice and help make them more effective.
Absolutely. Yeah, I this is almost a theme this season in BAPcast because we've talked about it a couple of times, but there's so many amazing resources from outside of the field. We're not the only ones working in the areas we're working in, and to to take a peek at what other folks are doing. And sometimes maybe their practices are not those that we would want to emulate, but sometimes they're doing some pretty useful, handy stuff, or they have good ideas that might require a little bit of interpretation and translation to work for what we're doing. But we look if we're looking at outcomes and you see a group doing something that seemingly works extremely well and it's helping contribute to meaningful outcomes, well, hey, they've got something there. Why don't we check that out and see if we can't translate it and use it? And I think also tying into what we've done historically in the field, I do some work on the topic of assent and behavior analysis, and sometimes people go like, oh, the paper you wrote, that was like a, such a new idea. It's not new in the slightest bit, to your point about the Bannerman 1990 paper. I mean, there was stuff before that, certainly. Even Skinner was talking about, counter control and clinical context and things like that. But I mean, that Bannerman paper, like, it completely fleshed everything out. I mean, it's an amazing paper. 1990, like, most of the framework was there. And, I think we can lose track of some of those really important historical contributions and in some ways are at risk of losing track of ourselves if we don't keep an eye on those things and keep those things front of mind.
Yeah, I think like the big point of the section is like what we're saying isn't new, just like what you're saying, Cody. Like they were talking about, personal welfare and the right to teach independent skills and, the rights and all these freedoms and dignities individuals with disabilities have and how we need to make them a part of their programming and involved and, all of the things that we talk about in the paper have already been said pretty much. And we just want to draw attention to that if we just look back in a lot of ways, we can really just, take that into perspective and really apply that. I think we could have just done all of that with just those couple papers that we mentioned.
Yeah, this has been a fun conversation and it's such an important topic. For those who are interested in, learning more about this or diving deeper in this topic, it sounds like you have a book that hopefully should be coming out soon. So the listeners should look to that and keep an eye out for that. Are there any other resources, could be articles, podcasts, like anything that people could check out to kind of further explore this at all?
I think me and Peter have poured pretty much all of our stuff into our book. So it's called Make It Meaningful, creating programs that matter into adulthood for learners with autism spectrum and related disorders. So it really highlights everything we talked about in this paper, but in a lot more detail, and it has a lot of kind of tools and clinical tools and resources that can really help kind of put it into practice. I don't know, Peter, anything else of other papers that we should refer to?
I just to wax philosophical for a bit. I think we need to make sure that people who become behavior analysts have are taught to respect the clients that they work with, are taught to understand contingencies with the eyes of their clients. You know, it's not their behavior. That it's I don't work for stimulus control. I look for I want my students and my adults to control their own lives. So I want to drop out as soon as I can, but I understand I have to be there sometimes for safety, and not everybody learns everything completely and all. But my job should be to put myself out of a job. You know, and I think if we adopt that headset, we have a much better chance of making a big impact.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, behavior analyst's job is to work themselves out of a job. So the perfect outcome is that we have nothing to do as behavior analysts, right? Our clients
Right.
no longer need us. I think that's probably true in education and most mental health services as
Yeah.
well, right? And it's certainly true for us. And I love that. I love this paper and I love this conversation because I think it helps maybe reorient us to what is important here. What are we aiming to do in our field and in our own practices? And I think this is a very, very helpful resource. I'm very excited for your book to come out. I'm excited to check it out myself. So thank you both for taking the time to write this paper. Thank you for taking time to write your book. I'm excited to check that out. And thank you for coming on the show today to talk about everything.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. Please remember to subscribe and like us on whatever podcast player you use. I'd also like to take a minute to thank a few people for helping create this podcast. Thank you to Stephanie Peterson, the editor of the journal Behavior Analysis and Practice. Thank you to ABAI for sponsoring this podcast. Thank you to my assistant producers for the season, Megan Ellsworth and Jesse Perrin. And thank you to Jim Carr and his band New Latitude for letting us sample their song Cruising Altitude throughout this podcast.